It's Ideasphere with Dr. Richard Carrier, Bayes' Theorem, and the Quest for the Historical Jesus.
You can only really have warranted belief. You can't have absolute certainty in things. And once you accept this, you can get over it and not worry about it. Because what you're doing is you're moving around through the world based on probabilities.
When discussions arise on the subject of the biblical Jesus, our emotions frequently overrule logic. In order to better understand the issue at hand, historian Richard Carrier proposes the use of Bayes' theorem. Basically, it's a mathematical formula used for calculating conditional probabilities. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbund. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Dr. Carrier. Among his many books and articles is Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus, and soon to be released, On the Historicity of Jesus, Why We Might Have Reason for Doubt. Carrier is a world-renowned author and speaker. As a professional historian, published philosopher, and prominent defender of the American free thought movement, he defends sound historical methods and the ethical worldview of secular naturalism. And Dr. Carrier joins me for this program. Thanks so much for taking this time.
No problem. I enjoy it.
The discussions of ontological discourse can be challenging, and I want to begin with that thought. Since we're working in the arena of logic and science, the other arena is a belief system and faith. How are the two ever going to be reconciled?
Right. Well, of course, it depends on your perspective on that, but I think objective scholarship, the scholarship that we have in universities, the kind of scholarship that we hold as objectively authoritative and rather than just dogma enforcing, you know, the difference between a university and the Vatican, for example, in terms of actual history as the academy respects it, in terms of objective methodologies, we do have to put faith aside and look at, can we defend this concept? Can we defend this proposition based on just evidence and reason without having to rely on any faith doctrines or any faith assumptions? And that's what most of what objective scholarship is about, both in the sciences as well as in history or any other fact-related field.
So when we're working on the historicity of Jesus, most of the information that we receive is from sources many years later, sometimes more than 100 years. How much faith, if I can use that phrase, do we put into those sources?
Well, certainly Christians of different sects today as then will put different amounts of faith into different documents based on whether it supports what they want to be true. Catholics have their own particular selection of texts, Protestants have their own, and so on. But from the perspective of objective scholarship, we look at what is the typical reliability of documents of a particular type from a particular type of source, given the time spans involved. And we know that faith literature in general in antiquity, and we know this from pagan faith literature, we know this from Jewish faith literature, and a lot of Christian faith literature, that most of it is forged or bogus, that most of it basically tells tales that aren't true and markets them as true to achieve a particular objective. And we see this in Jewish literature as well as Christian literature and pagan literature, that this is all just the norm of the time. So we do have to be very suspicious and very skeptical. And when we look at texts, and we have to sort of figure out, like, why would we trust this? On what evidence is it based? And so on. And it can be very challenging. In the case of the historicity of Jesus, like whether he existed or not, we have very little documentation that we can count on. And what we can count on tells us very little, or it's very problematic. And it was unclear as to what exactly it's telling us. So that's the problem that we're faced with in studying Jesus, which we don't face in studying certain other things. If you're studying the history of the emperors, you often have a really large database of really reliable kinds of evidence. It's not all 100% reliable, but it's more reliable than the kinds of stuff that we have for Christianity. So when we're studying the emperors, we can do a lot more, we can say a lot more. When we're studying Jesus, it's much fuzzier, much more difficult. And one analogy that I've used is, and this is something someone else came up with, was the idea, and if we assume Jesus existed, what we're looking at is something similar to what happened to Rastafarianism. And Rastafarianism is a Jamaican religion that started by believing that Haile Selassie, who was the emperor of Ethiopia at the time, was the second coming of Christ, and that he survived his death and lives on, and they can pray to him and so on. He even denied this in his life, but yet the religion persisted. And these faith documents have grown up, these sort of gospels of Haile Selassie that have, you know, ridiculous myths in them and so on, that are all untrue, but, you know, loosely based on certain facts about his life. If you can imagine, like, 1,000, 2,000 years from now, if the only records that survived were the Rastafarians' faith literature, it would be exceedingly difficult to reconstruct what was actually true about Haile Selassie. And that's the situation we're faced with when we're looking at Jesus, because none of the eyewitness secular sources there may have been, if there even were any, has survived. All we have is Christian faith literature, and even stuff outside of Christianity, all they're doing is responding to what Christians were telling them. So even that is not independent of Christian faith literature. So it's a really problematic field to try and study.
And you're up against the odds, because those who believe in this are accepting it on face value rather than what you feel would be more valid if Jesus, you say, was a cosmic being bringing the revelations through secret messages in Scripture.
Oh, certainly. One of the biggest problems that we face in academia now in terms of biblical studies is that most people in biblical studies who are doing this work are Christians and have particular faith doctrines they're defending. Not necessarily conservatives. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of conservative Christians, fundamentalist Christians, and so on, also in this field. But there are also a lot of liberal Christians who have their own liberal agendas, their own liberal faith doctrines that they want to support, that would be undermined if we were to conclude that Christianity began very differently than they think it did. And that's the view that I'm defending in the upcoming book, which will be on the historicity of Jesus. And I do hint at it in Proving History, which is the book that came out a couple of years ago, which examined these methodologies and how we would approach this question. But what I think originally happened, and I'm not the first one to think of this, Earl Doherty and other scholars before me have, is that Jesus began as this revealed being, a celestial archangel type being that people learned of and learned that he had become incarnate and died and was buried and resurrected from the dead in a cosmic realm, not on earth. And that they learned of this through secret messages in Scripture and through revelations they received directly from this being. And then only later were historical narratives created to put him on earth interacting with historical people, which was a phenomenon that happened a lot in antiquity. There are several cosmic gods that this happened to, that the earthly narratives were created for them. So it actually fits within the type of faith literature that people were writing at the time. And it just so happened that the one sect that started promoting or believing that these things were historically true rather than allegorical, which was the original intent, that's the sect that survived, and that's the sect that decided what evidence to preserve, what evidence not to preserve, and the sect that decided what evidence to doctor and how to doctor it. And we have lots of examples of all of these things. And so that makes it very difficult to try and get back to the original truth. And that's the reason why it's been so long in coming. It requires a great deal of detective work to look at the evidence that survived, to see the clues that show how Christianity probably originally began, and then how it was changed and how the record was changed to sort of reflect the new doctrine that arose 100 years later.
The book you have soon to release, you just mentioned, was The Historicity of Jesus and Why We Might Have Reason to Doubt. You also mentioned the previous book, Proving History. That's Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus, which has been in print for a couple of years. Your website, any information you'd like to pass along to anyone?
Certainly, richardcarrier.info is the place to go to learn everything about my work in both history and philosophy. But for this particular subject, the most important place to go right now would be my blog, which you can get to from that link. I've been writing about this theory because I've been working on it since 2008, working on these books to produce them. So I've written about it. I've debated it with scholars in the field. I've interacted with scholars trying to argue the opposite. So you'll find a lot of that, like videos related to that, discussions related to that on my blog.
Okay. I'll have that information posted at Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. In case you're just tuning in, you can hear this program at Public Radio Exchange. Dr. Richard Carrier, whose soon-to-be-released book, On the Historicity of Jesus, Why We Might Have Reason for Doubt. Previous, Bayes' Theorem on the Quest for the Historical Jesus. The Empty Tomb, Jesus Beyond the Grave. And for more information, go to richardcarrier.info. We'll have that posted at Public Radio Exchange. I want to return to this Bayes' Theorem. How accessible do you feel this information is to the layperson?
It's as accessible as I could make it. I mean, I specifically wrote the book for humanities majors, but of course, any smart person can read a text that is written for humanities majors. So if you think you can get at this stuff, you don't have to be a math genius. And in fact, I've kind of wrote it for mathophobes, people who are scared of math. The only math you need to understand the concepts involved is really sixth grade math. You don't need any more than that. There are some concepts in the last chapter of the book that are a little more advanced, but that's why I put them in the last chapter. They're not essential. They're more for people who want to dig deeper into the conceptology of the mathematical model and so on. So I put all of that in the back, in the end of the book. And everything else up to that, though, I think pretty much anyone can get at. There might be one or two places where you're not sure what I'm saying, but for the majority of it, it really did aim to teach this to just ordinary people who aren't used to thinking of the world in terms of math. And I've had a lot of experience doing this with tutorials and lectures and stuff. I had an idea of how to do it, and I'm getting better at it too. But this book, I think, is probably the only book that I've found in all my research that tries to explain how to think using Bayes' theorem to just average everyday people, rather than trying to fill the whole thing with nothing but equations or talking really jargonized mathematical talk. I don't do any of that. I try to really make it explicable and understandable to everyone. And this is the first book, I think, that's done that.
Some are going to look at this and see those mathematical equations. In reality, they're calculus and algebra. But if you'd like more information, I would direct someone to your website where you have an interactive use of this theorem.
I do, yes. Bayes Calculator. I have certain fans in the community that are coders. Actually, there have been a few that have been written. So these online web interfaces where you can play around with Bayes' theorem and Bayesian equations. But the one that's on my website, if you go to richardcarrier.info and the Jesus Studies link, one of the things listed in there is this Bayesian calculator, which you can go to and you can read about it there. It explains how to toy with it, and then you can play around with it. It'll do all the math for you, and you can just enter certain numbers and see how it works.
How many come back with the response that, wait a minute, what has math to do with history?
Yeah, and that, I think, is one of the most important things that I had to explain in my book, Proving History. And I do. I mean, if you want the full answer to that question, really the book is the place to go. In general, the way to understand it is that Bayes' theorem is essentially a mathematical model of all correct empirical reasoning. So all empirical reasoning that's correct, all reasoning about facts, if it's sound and valid reasoning, it's actually Bayesian. And so if you understand the mathematical model for what correct reasoning looks like, you can use that to look at a particular argument and see, is this argument reasoning correctly or not? And you could use it to do that. You can use it to develop new methods and so on. It makes it much easier to sort of figure out the difference between conclusion reached logically from premises versus sort of gut feelings and intuition and stuff like that. When you're reading historians, oftentimes you can't tell whether the historian is telling you something that's just their intuition or their gut feeling or whatever, or whether they actually have a sound and valid logical argument from premises to conclusion. And no one's really worked out what the fundamental logic of historical reasoning is, and that's what I sought out to do with Proving History. And I found that it is Bayes' theorem is the model. So if you understand that model, you can apply it and you can use it, and you start to see the world differently. And you start to see, when you look at historical writing, you can apply it to that and figure out, like, should I believe this or should I not? It's a very useful tool in that respect. And certainly for American citizens, our politics depend so much on journalism and history. This mathematical model applies to that as well. So you could actually use it to figure out, like, who's telling you the truth and who's not. Really, more probably than not, since it deals with probabilities, you can figure out who's more likely telling the truth when there's different accounts of what happened in history. It's a valuable tool if you can figure it out. And that's what I wrote the book for, is for to help people figure it out and figure out how to apply it in their lives.
One of the earliest problems that you assess through this theorem is the blotting out of the sun that reportedly occurred at Jesus's death. It occurred for several hours. However, if you look at the historical data, there is no evidence anyone witnessed that, with the exception of what's in the Gospels.
That's right, yeah. I use that as a good example because it's a simple one. It's pretty obvious what the correct solution to that is. And I use that as a model to show you how, when we reason through that, what we're doing already is Bayesian reasoning. So it's a good teaching tool. But the basic idea for that was that the Gospel of Mark, and then only the Gospels that copy him, so Matthew and Luke, and then much later literature that copies them. So it really comes down to one source, Mark. He basically invented this story that when Jesus was crucified, the sun went out for 3 hours and the whole world went dark. Now, of course, had that actually happened, there would have been tons of witnesses and evidence throughout the historical record of the Roman Empire and beyond the Roman Empire and Persian records and so on, possibly even China, depending on the time of day, for example. But certainly Persia and the Roman Empire would have records of this, but there's no reference to it. No one noticed it. And it's impossible that no one would notice it. And when we say impossible, what we mean is really, really, really improbable. So we're talking about probabilities here. Whereas if Mark just made it up, that's exactly the evidence we would have. That would be very probable that it would appear in one hagiography, one holy scripture about someone, because it was very typical at the time for hagiographies, you know, sacred biographies, to make stuff up, to make their figure look more impressive. So that was common. So that's exactly what we'd expect. We would see it in just the faith literature and nowhere else. Whereas if it actually happened, we should see tons of more evidence, but we don't. So when you compare those two probabilities, the great improbability of no one else mentioning it versus the great probability that if it didn't happen, the evidence would look exactly like we see it, you can use that to show that it's very improbable that this event occurred. That's part of Bayesian reasoning. There are other aspects to it, but that's an example of the way you look at it in terms of comparing probabilities.
But then you also add that science is subordinate to history.
Well, I think they're mutually subordinate. Science, of course, depends upon historical records, right? So all scientific data is a form of historical record. And when scientists build on previous scientific work, they're relying on the historical record for that. For example, all the experiments that confirmed relativity under Einstein, we're assuming that we're receiving that information correctly, that those experiments were done and that they actually occurred the way that they were reported. So science is really dependent on history in lots of ways. And this is especially the case in certain sciences where the evidence has been lost but it once existed. For example, if you're doing fossil work or geological work where those fossils or geological structures have since been destroyed by erosion or other phenomena. War is another thing that's erased some evidence. Mm-hmm. Scientists do depend on history. But at the same time, historians depend on science because scientists figure out how the world works generally. And historians need to know that in order, when they look at documents, to figure out who's lying and who's not or what stories are made up and whatnot. They need to know how the world actually works so they can figure out the most probable explanation for the evidence that they see from antiquity, for example. So they are mutually interdependent. But there are also sciences that are historical. For example, geology. Geology studies what has happened in the past throughout the history of the Earth. That's a historical science. So there's a lot of overlap between history and science. And when you get down to the bare structure of how they're arguing from premise to conclusion, they're all arguing in the same way. They're all relying on Bayes' theorem. And whether that's explicit or not, whether they're aware of it or not, that's what they're doing. And that's one thing that I show in my book.
Dr. Richard Carrier, Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus, and On the Historicity of Jesus, Why We Have Reason to Doubt. His website, richardcarrier.info. He'll be speaking at the San Luis Obispo Senior Citizens Center this Saturday, April 19th at 4 o'clock. More information at atheistsunited.org. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back.
And you're listening to Ideasphere on KCBX, public radio serving South Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties. Time now to check out the KCBX community calendar. There's an Easter egg hunt on the lawn behind the South Bay Community Center in Los Osos on Saturday morning. It's run by the Bay Osos Kiwanis Club, who are also offering face painting, a petting zoo, and a free hot dog lunch. For all those details, check out the community calendar at kcbx.org. The time is 11 minutes before 2 o'clock.
back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Dr. Richard Carrier, soon to be released the book On the Historicity of Jesus, Why We Might Have Reason for Doubt, published soon by Sheffield Phoenix. Let's look at the evidence to the claim which you refer to as the causal hypothesis and how that fits into the blotting out of the sun.
Yeah, most of historical reasoning is reasoning about causes. And I don't just mean in the sense that we want to know why things happened in history. That's obviously an important question in history and one of the things we try to answer. But even when we ask the question, what happened in history, what we're really talking about is a causal hypothesis. In other words, when we look at the evidence that we have now, what we're theorizing is what caused that evidence to exist. And that's when we come up with the conclusion that, well, certain events happened, these particular events happened, and that's why we have the evidence that we have now. That's why it's in the condition that it is now, and so on. So all historical reasoning is fundamentally causal. We're looking for the causes of the current state of the world, the causes of the current state of the evidence that we have, the causes of the different kinds of evidence that we have. And the most likely cause is what we conclude actually happened in the past. And that's all of historical reasoning reduces to that.
There are so many discrepancies that you and others have found in the Bible. And even those who are, let's say, anti-Christian or atheist are arguing different points of view, such as the birth of Christ. One of the things you talk about in your work is the discrepancy between whether or not he was born during one reign or another, Herod being one. This has gone on for decades.
More than, actually.
How about centuries?
Quite possibly. I mean, technically, you could probably argue back 2,000 years, depending on what particular aspect of the debate you want to focus on. But yes, certainly, the Gospel of Matthew says that Jesus was born when Herod the Great was still alive and shortly before his death. So that would put Jesus' birth sometime between 4 or 6 BC. But Luke, however, says that Jesus was born 10 years after Herod the Great had died. He says that Jesus was born during the census of Quirinius, when Quirinius was the governor of Syria, and he was appointed governor of Syria, and Judea was annexed to Syria and therefore subject to the Roman census in 6 AD. So here we have 10 or more years discrepancy between them, and they can't be reconciled. There have been attempts by Christian apologists for decades at least, and if not longer, to try and reconcile these two contradictions, but they only do so by coming up with illogical or factually incorrect premises. This is one thing that I've done a lot of research on, and in fact, my article on summarizing why they can't be reconciled despite all of the attempts to reconcile them, and I summarize all of those attempts and analyze them, is in another book that I came out with, which is Hitler, Homer, Bible, Christ, which just came out a couple months ago, which is basically a collection of all my peer-reviewed papers, all my magazine articles, plus a variety of other research projects and blog posts. And this is one of them, is the extensive article on why Luke and Matthew don't agree on what year Jesus was born in and why we can't get them to harmonize. There is no plausible way to harmonize them.
Logical and empirical truths. This, too, is a part of what a historian has to deal with, and you use the Bayes theory in order to handle that.
Certainly, empirical conclusions are probabilistic. In other words, there's always some probability that we're wrong. And so really the whole task in dealing with empirical questions is to figure out how likely is it that we're wrong? Is that probability so small that we can ignore it? Or is it large enough that we should take it into account and consider it? Whereas logical conclusions, deductive logical conclusions, are conclusions that are absolutely certainly true, provided the premises are true. Now, it just so happens that if you analyze this, go layer under layer, you find out that the premises are ultimately empirical as well. So really everything is empirical reasoning. But there are steps and links between one premise to another conclusion that you can say are logically certain using this kind of method. Is that what you were asking about?
Yes, thank you. And the reason for that is I was getting to another portion of your work later on. You talk about the criticism of the Bayes theory and whether or not as a theory it is a warrant rather than a truth.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, that's a good one. Certainly the theorem itself, if you have the premises and the conclusion that results is deductively certain. So it's a logically certain truth as long as the premises are true. But the problem is the premises are always probabilistic. When you're talking about conclusions, for example, can we be absolutely certain that Julius Caesar existed. We can't be absolutely certain, because there's always some really tiny probability that we're delusional, or that we've hallucinated the evidence, or that we're brains in a vat and aliens are just feeding us information. I mean, there's all these possibilities, but they're extremely improbable, so we discount them generally. So really what all Bayes' theorem tells you is, given what you know right now, how probable is it that the things you think you know are true? And so there's always some probability that you're wrong about that. And that's why I describe Bayes' theorem as a theory of warrant, meaning at what point are you warranted in saying you know something? At what point is your belief warranted in something? And that's really all you can hope for. Even a omniscient God couldn't have better, because an omniscient God, you would say, well, he's infallible, so surely he would know with 100% certainty everything he knows is true. But the problem is that he might be deceived in being infallible. In other words, there might be some other demon or something that has tricked him into thinking he's infallible and thinking he's omniscient. And there's no way that even a God could get around this and be absolutely certain that that's not the case. Even an ideal mind, like a supernatural deified mind, you know, a God's mind, could never get around the fact that there is always some probability that they're wrong. And so you can only really have warranted belief. You can't have absolute certainty in things. And once you accept this, you can get over it and not worry about it. Because what you're doing is you're moving around through the world based on probabilities. You're assuming that an asteroid is not going to destroy the Earth tomorrow, right? There is an actual measurable probability that that will happen, but it's extremely small, so it's safe to assume that it's not going to happen. We go through our lives on that assumption. We do that all every day. We do that. We're capable of handling life that way. So once we see that that's what we're doing in life, it makes it much easier to have an open mind. And at the same time, it makes it much easier to realize at what point you should stop being skeptical. At what point should you believe something? And what do you mean when you say that you finally do believe something or that you know something?
What's the biggest challenge you face when you go out and speak before large groups? Are there certain questions that are almost unanswerable?
Regarding the Bayesian reasoning aspect?
Well, anything that a critic of your work may approach.
Certainly there are unanswerable questions. There's lots of questions about the origins of Christianity that I would love to be able to answer, but we just don't have the evidence we need to be able to answer them. Those are very annoying things. So, for example, who were the first apostles? We don't really know that. The Gospels aren't really in agreement on this. From the letters of Paul, Paul's talking about apostles before him that are not even listed in the Gospels. So there's a lot of questions like that. There's questions about what happened to Egyptian Christianity, because there is Alexandria was right next to Judea on the trade route. It was a major city. It was a major population, had a major population of Jews. So it would have been a perfect place for Christians to evangelize. And we know Christians did. They sent evangelists there. But we have no record of the church there. So, for example, in Acts, in the book of Acts in the New Testament, never talks about Egypt or Alexandria, that you never hear anything about what was going on there. That would be one of the most important things to know, because we have certain authors like Philo, who's this Jewish theologian of the time, and there's a lot of affinities between his theology and Christian theology, but he never mentions Christians, so he doesn't appear to ever have heard of them. But the question then arises, to what extent did his writings influence Christian thought? And that's something that would be interesting to know, but we just can't, because the data is lost.
So many challenges. Thank you so much for your time. I know there's so much more we could talk about.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Richard Carrier, Bayes' Theorem and the Quest for the Historical Jesus, and On the Historicity of Jesus, Why We Have Reason to Doubt. His website, richardcarrier.info. He'll be speaking at the San Luis Obispo Senior Citizens Center this Saturday, April 19th at 4 o'clock. More information at atheistsunited.org. If you have any comments or questions about this broadcast of Ideasphere or a proposal for any new programs, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.